I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Bree Pettis, the co-founder of MakerBot Industries, a company that makes three-dimensional printers. So instead of producing ink on paper, the machine makes actual objects made out of plastic. Bree started the company in 2009 with his partners Zach Hokensmith and Adam Mayer. Prior to starting MakerBot, Bree was a public elementary school teacher in Seattle, Washington, a puppeteer, and an artist. He also is one of the founders of NYC Resistor, a hacker collective located in Brooklyn. Bree's also a video podcast producer, TV host, and father. Welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
What is MakerBot?
So a MakerBot is a machine that can make you anything. It's a replicator. So let's say you want something, you can imagine it and design it, or maybe somebody else has made it and you can download it, and then you just print it out. So say you need a bottle opener, you just print one out, and then you're opening bottles.
It's made out of plastic that feels kind of like Legos. What kind of plastic is it?
Well, there's two kinds of plastic you can use in a MakerBot right now, and we're exploring more. We're looking for more things to print with. But you can use ABS or PLA. ABS is a really common plastic. It's what most of the plastic you have in your life is made out of. It's like it's the same thing that Lego's made out of. PLA is another plastic we use, and it's made from corn, and it is biodegradable, and when you make things out of it, it smells like waffles.
3D printers have been around for decades, but they are very expensive and hundreds of thousands of dollars and huge, but your printers cost roughly $1,300. What was the impetus for wanting to create a cheaper 3D printer?
Well, we really wanted one, and they were really expensive. And so we just used the materials we had at hand and the tools we had at hand. We have a laser cutter that we share, and we just kept trying. So we locked ourselves up in our hackerspace with literally two cases of ramen and a lot of Club Mate, which is a caffeinated beverage. And we basically just camped out there making prototype after prototype. And we'd been working all through the night for days.
What was the first object you made with your 3D printer when it finally worked?
Oh, we promptly printed out a shot glass and had drinks.
You promptly printed out a shot glass and then hopped on a plane to South by Southwest, which is a leading technology innovative conference in Austin. What did South by Southwest lead to, if anything, for you?
Well, you know, we had made 20 kits for people to have their own 3D printer. And we thought, okay, we'll sell 10, and then we'll have 10 to sell next month. And then, of course, we sold those, like, really quickly. Like, within 2 weeks, we had sold out of the thing we thought would take 2 months to sell. So the race was on.
Who buys these 3D machines?
You know, the people who buy 3D printers are a real mix, because you've got some, you know, you've got the obvious kind of engineers, hackers, programmer types that get them. And then you've got just ordinary people who live in the future who want to have a machine that can make anything so that when they need something, they don't have to go to the store. They can just print it out and have it.
It takes a little while for you to kind of get your hands around exactly what it is we're talking about. Maybe it's my failure of imagination, but it took me some time to actually understand, okay, well, this is a printer not producing ink, but actually making stuff.
Yeah, it's a replicator. It replicates your ideas into real objects. It makes things, your ideas, real. And, you know, we're used to being consumers. We're used to, you know, if we want a clock, we think, okay, well, where do I go shop for that? Mm-hmm. When you have a MakerBot, the world's different. You see the world through MakerBot glasses. You can actually print out glasses. But when you have a MakerBot, you think, okay, I need a clock. Well, maybe I'll MakerBot one. And in fact, a group of folks actually did collaborate, and they made a grandfather clock mechanism that's just beautiful and ticks and everything.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bree Pettis, the co-founder of MakerBot Industries, a company that makes open source robots that make plastic objects. You grew up in Ithaca, New York, and then moved to Seattle, Washington. What was your home life like? What did your parents do, for example?
My dad is, he's a marketer. His website is brand.com, so he's been doing it for a while. And my mom does a bunch of stuff, including art.
How did you become interested in making things or tinkering? Do you remember, do you have early experiences of just being very hands-on?
You know, I got into tinkering when I went to go visit my Aunt Meredith, who at that time was married to a guy named Joe. And Joe, his job was every morning he'd wake up and I'd get into his pickup truck with him at like 4 a.m. in Boston. He knew all the trash routes. And we'd go on the trash routes before the trash men came. And we'd pick out all the good stuff. And then during the week, during the day, he would fix that stuff up and on the weekend sell it at a flea market. And that week, we picked up a couple bikes that were broken and put them together. And he made me feel like I knew, like he let me put things together and figure out how it worked so that at the end, it was really my bike. I'd put that bike together, even though I was like 7.
By the way, where does the name Bree come from?
So my name Bree is short for Bree Huspety, and it comes from my parents who were hippies at the time. Their yogi gave me that name.
Your parents were not in the technology field at all, but your grandfather was. He also made machines. What kind of work did he do?
So my grandpa had a company called High Speed Checkware in Ithaca. His company made machines that would weigh things really quickly. So when Morton salt comes down the production line in long lines of circular tubes, his machine would be on the line, and it would quickly weigh things. And if there wasn't enough salt in one of the containers, it would knock it off. So he made machines that would weigh things at a high speed.
When you were growing up in Seattle, you know, Bill Gates, Microsoft was pretty big. Did that have any impact on your thinking at all?
You know, Microsoft is something I had friends whose parents worked at Microsoft, and Bill Gates moved into the neighborhood. And I don't know so much one of the things that did affect me is I had a friend who worked at Nintendo, and Paul Scanlon had a job where his job was to play games all day. He was a tester, and then later on he was a game counselor, because back in those days you could call, if you didn't mind paying long distance, you could call up Nintendo and talk to somebody and be like, I can't get through this level, and they'd be like, go find the magic hammer and hit it this wall with it, mm-hmm, that kind mm-hmm. of thing. And that was his job. And I remember thinking, oh, that's such a, you know, that's a job that somebody does. Like, that exists in the world. Like, mm-hmm. there's not just, like, you're going to be a doctor or a nurse or a farmer or something like this. There's people who play games for a living. I thought, okay, anything can happen.
How much was the notion of you're having to make a living, how large did that loom in your career choices, for example?
For me, in terms of my career, I've always felt really strongly to, you know, follow my heart. I read, you know, the whole Joseph Campbell Power of Myth series and was very inspired to follow my passion. And so you don't go into teaching to make money. I think after 7 years, I was making about $31,000 a year. But I was there because I wanted to create infrastructure for people to make things, to learn how to be creative. And that's been a thread through my whole life, the idea of creating infrastructure for people to be creative and being creative.
You've been a public school teacher, but what was your own education like?
You know, it was mixed. I mean, I dropped out of middle school because I just didn't want to go, and I was having to face bullies and get into fights all the time. So I just dropped out of seventh grade and was happy to do so. And then, you know, later on, I realized, like, okay, school, fine. I see how this works. I have to do this to make other things happen. Basically, I kind of got back into school when I was, like, a sophomore, and I realized, okay, I'll jump through the hoops to make sure I can make something else happen. And then I got lucky, and I ended up going to the Evergreen State College, which is a liberal arts college in Olympia, Washington, where there are no requirements except that you have to have X amount of credits before you can graduate. So you can study anything. I studied everything from political science and history to education and ethnomusicology and mythology and psychology, and ended up doing dance for 2 years and being in a samba band and playing gamelan. And so I was able to just continually explore different kinds of things and try different things out.
You talk about dropping out of school in seventh grade. So you're 12 years old. What does that mean? Like, you wake up in the morning and what do you do?
You know, as a kid, when you go to school and you're the first 6 months of school are full of intimidation and bullying, you just find a way to not go. You just wake up and you think, I'm not going.
Where'd you go? What'd you do?
I just stayed at home and read books.
What did your parents say?
It didn't matter. I wasn't going.
But what did they say?
I don't remember.
So they didn't have much choice.
No, I wasn't going.
What was the experience like for you of being an elementary school teacher in the public school system in Seattle? Was it creative as you had hoped?
As a teacher, I got to be the art teacher, which is one of the last places you're actually not bound by teaching to the test in American public schools. And so I got to teach kids how to make things, how to sew a button. Most kids don't know how to sew a button if they lose a button. They don't know how to put it back. So there's kind of basic skills like that that are really satisfying and make young people feel really independent. But the bureaucracy and the underfundedness of schools these days means that really there's not enough resources to do to be effective as a teacher and with 32 kids in a classroom. It eventually wears you down. After being a school teacher for 7 years, I can honestly say, like, if you can, drop out of school. If you're somebody who can follow your passion and try things out and develop infrastructure for yourself, if you have that kind of discipline, find other ways to learn things.
So here you were, a frustrated art teacher, and you said, okay, I'm going to move to Brooklyn. Talk to me about that moment.
So there were a couple things that happened. I had come to New York on vacation, and I had seen some video art at an art gallery. And I said, this is neat. I want one. How much is this artwork? And they said, well, the DVD is $15,000. And I had that kind of like Picasso moment of like, yeah, I could do that. Mm-hmm. So I went back and I made a video, and that was an art video called the I Love You Project. And I took it around to galleries in Seattle, and I said, here's my video. I'm ready to display it. And they all liked it. But after, a month or two, it had been seen by like 4 people, and nothing had happened. So I was like, screw this. I'm putting it on the internet. And sure enough, after like a few months, like 50,000 people had watched it. And I was like, okay, that's more than Phil's Mariners Stadium, But I like this. I like this kind of attention. So I started making more videos. I made videos for my students. Next thing you know, I'm making videos for Make Magazine. Then I moved to New York, and where I continued to work on making videos for Make Magazine. Worked for Etsy for a bit, and then quit that to start MakerBot.
Etsy being the online marketplace for handmade items. I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bree Pettis, the co-founder of MakerBot. We'll hear more from Bree coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Bree Pettis, the co-founder of MakerBot Industries, a company that makes 3D printers. So instead of producing ink on paper, the machine makes actual objects made out of plastic. Bree started the company in 2009 with his partners Zach Hokensmith and Adam Mayer. Prior to starting MakerBot, Bree was a public elementary school teacher in Seattle, Washington, a puppeteer, and an artist. He also is one of the founders of NYC Resistor, a hacker collective located in Brooklyn. You've been willing to expose yourself, your private life, to some extent, publicly, using the internet.
Sure.
And you've been blogging since 2004. And I'd love for you to read one of your blogs from 2004. It's entitled Dream. Okay.
Okay.
You're laughing. Why are you laughing?
Here we go. So I've been blogging for a long time. I actually had a blog in 99, but it was anonymous and I ended up erasing it. It's this idea of sharing what you're thinking. Okay. And then I got at one point in 2004, I was like, okay, I'm just going to share everything, including my dreams. So I just woke up from a dream that involved going to the transmission shop, driving to a farm owned by my brother, enjoying the farm, and then falling from a pulley cable slide. My brother was played by Tom Hanks, and when I fell, I began screaming incoherently, and I was paralyzed with a plastic sword in each hand. Even though I was screaming inside, I knew the tragedy because I would die, and I would miss out on marrying the love of my life, and I would miss my brother, and all the things I want to do would never be done. Tom Hanks carried me through 3 feet of deep of water, and I was still screaming in my dream as I woke up. My dream reflected a few things to me. First of all, I love my brother, and I love having a brother. Secondly, I touched on a deep sadness in me. I've experienced loss, and I can touch that sadness in myself. I've been having a lot of dreams lately. feels like a time of change in my life. My modus operandi has been to go with the flow and accept the events and things that come to me in life and nurture those opportunities. I've changed a little now in that I am searching to build something. I'm searching for a path that I can set out on. No more hitchhiking through life. I want to drive my own train.
How do you feel reading that now?
You know, one of the nice things about having a blog is that you're leaving, you leave breadcrumbs for yourself to say, like, okay, this is where I'm at now. And so I can see then in 2004, I wanted to start making things happen more. I wanted to be like, okay, let's do things. You know, I think this is a little bit of a moment where you can see, like, okay, I wanted something, but I didn't know what. It took me a few years to get to a place where I'm quite happy with driving things.
You talk about being deeply sad. What made you deeply sad at that point in your life?
I don't know, actually. I'm not sure.
What is your feeling about, you know, sharing your personal life and
So when I first started making videos, I was video blogger like number 13 in this early crew of video bloggers. And I was making videos for my students, and I was making personal videos, and I was sharing them. And we grew this community of like 25 or 30 people. And we were just making videos that were like, let me show you my apartment. Mm-hmm. And people weren't doing this at the time. So it felt like, okay, we're in this club of people who are sharing, you know look at what my cat did today. And it sounds kind of silly to say today because YouTube is just absurdly full of this kind of stuff. But back then it really felt like we're breaking new ground. We're finding new ways to share. And sharing is really important to me. It's one of those things where, if you are not somebody who shares, you should be, because there's a future out there that is sadder if you don't. We're in a nice time where just in the past few years, sharing has become something that has value. You know, and even if you just share stories about how you dealt with something or how you got your baby to sleep at night or whatever, it means you're leaving breadcrumbs for other people so they won't feel as alone, so that when they go to learn how to do something, they can build on what you did and take it to the next level.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bree Pettis, the co-founder of MakerBot Industries, a company that makes three-dimensional printers that produce plastic objects. You moved to Brooklyn in 2007, and prior to starting MakerBot, you were one of the creators of NYC Resistor, which is a hacker collective, which allows people to tinker with software and technology. But the word hacker kind of has this negative connotation that, like, you're invading somebody else's technology. What was the purpose of this hacker collective in Brooklyn?
So NYC Resistor is a really special place. You enter it, and there's a laser cutter. There's a big table where there's lots of people working on their laptops. There's soldering irons where people are assembling electronics. And there's, you know, all sorts of tools and materials. A member of NYC Resistor can make anything. Our motto is, we learn, share, and make things. When people think about hacker, a lot of times they think about, like, oh, somebody's breaking into my computer. But I believe a hacker is somebody who's got a special enthusiasm for figuring out how things work and using them in special ways. An example of somebody who, when we first started, we came out, our first model 3D printer was the Cupcake. It was inexpensive, it worked, and it was great. But it was our first machine, so there was a lot of room for improvement. Because we shared all the designs, people could hack on it. They could improve it. And they did. They built all these crazy adaptations. They took the Z stage, which is the part that goes up and down. They ripped the back off it. They put their own one on. And they could do that because they could print out replacement parts that improved the machine. Mm-hmm. And every time this happened, we celebrated it. We were like, cool. This person found a way of taking what we did and improving on it, mm-hmm, and sharing back with the community.
You met Zach Hokensmith and Adam Mayer, your co-founders of MakerBot, at NYC Resistor, and you decided you wanted to make a go of this as a company, and you raised $75,000 from friends and family initially, and that $75,000 turned into $5 million of revenue. Were you surprised by the level of demand for this?
Yeah, I mean, we started it off, and we were like, okay, this. When we started, we kind of fooled ourselves, thinking, yeah, we'll just start this. This will be something we do. Maybe we'll do other stuff, too. And then as soon as we sold the first 20 in no time flat, we were like, okay, now we got to make more. Mm-hmm. And so we spent that first 3 months prototyping and getting ready, and then we launched our product. Then we spent the next like 9 or 10 months just figuring out how to pack and ship and put labels on things and count out nuts and bolts and stuff like this.
How were you supporting yourself at the time financially?
Oh, we were broke. We weren't paying ourselves. Every time we got, you know, money, we were spending it on robot parts. I skipped rent 1 month just because I didn't have it. We're a committed group. We were really into it.
To what extent did being broke scare you?
Well, being broke sucks. It means you can't take your girlfriend out to dinner, and it's pretty stressful. But it, you know, to counter that, we knew we were onto something, and we had to ride. We had to ride it as hard as we could and push it as hard as we could so we can get as many of them out there and change the world.
You talk about being broke while you were trying to get the company off the ground, and it was hard to not be able to take your girlfriend out to dinner. Your girlfriend at the time became your eventual partner and the mother of your child. How did you meet Keo Stark?
We met playing Werewolf, which is a game where you try and use deceit and lying to survive in a town of werewolves. And this is a real-life game. It's not online. And together, you are a village, and you have to figure out, and there's werewolves in the village, and you have to figure out who they are, except you don't know who they are because they look like people. So you have to figure out who's lying.
Was either of you a werewolf?
Absolutely not. We were both villagers. I met Keo, and we were talking about trying to effectively lie, trying to come up with strategies for that, and Keo's a horrible liar. And so that was a nice way to kind of start with an honest moment about deception, I guess.
Is there a community of werewolf players out there somewhere?
Werewolf is one of those games that's gotten popular on like conferences. Mm-hmm. So after the conference, you'll get like 10 or 12, 15 people together and a bunch of drinks, and you'll sit around and lie to each other. See if you can figure out who's lying.
Keo is an author, and she recently wrote a novel called Follow Me Down. She's also written a manual, a handbook called Don't Go Back to School.
Keo did a lot of interviews with people to figure out how they learned things without going to school. Mm-hmm. So it's all about how to learn things without having to pay for it.
You've created with Keo a manifesto of sorts called The Cult of Done. How do you live your life, or how do you express this cult of done?
There's some things like, you know, if you have an idea and you don't execute it within a week, throw it away. Don't do it. Mm-hmm. Abandon it. Then there's things like done is the engine of more. So when you finish something, it means you can do more. So finish more things so you can start more things. Another one is like everything is a rough draft. Don't strive for perfection. Just get it to a place where you're satisfied.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bree Pettis, the co-founder of MakerBot Industries, a company that makes open source robots that make plastic objects. MakerBot's 3D printers produce objects used for designing, recreation, and practical life. So things like bathtub plugs, shower curtain rings, bottle openers. A MakerBot printer costs roughly $1,300. I want to talk some more about the varied applications of some of the objects that MakerBot produces.
Sure.
For instance, somebody made an engagement ring out of a MakerBot machine. What's that story?
So there's a guy named Finnflood, and he was going to Iceland the next day with his sweetie. And he thought, you know, it's Friday night, and he thought, maybe this would be a great time. This would be a beautiful place. Maybe I'll find a beautiful place to go and pop the question. But I need a ring, and it's late, and I'm leaving tomorrow. So he popped around to his local hackerspace and printed one out, and they went to Iceland, and he gave it to her, and she said yes. And it's a really nice story because it means, like, you can have a MakerBot and print out anything, really.
That's one small example, but do you have, like, a larger mission or hope for the company? I mean, here's somebody who makes, you know, an engagement ring, but what does this look like on a larger scale? Or it might just be like you just want people to make stuff.
Well, when we started, we saw those first 20 machines and we thought, okay, here's potential energy. This is going out there, and people are going to use these machines to make anything they want. And now that we've got, goodness, 7,000 machines are out in the wild right now, 7,000 MakerBots, we're seeing what people are doing. Every day there's new things that people are making. You know, they're making cookie cutters, they're making robots, they're making characters, they're making remote control cars. The thing that's getting me excited these days is, what will we do together? What can 7,000 MakerBots in the world do? One of the projects we're working on right now is called Project Shelter. We're making shells for hermit crabs, because hermit crabs are facing a housing shortage. So we're helping them.
What's wrong with the shells of hermit crabs now?
Hermit crabs don't make their own shells. And humans take them away from the beach. And the snails that make the shells that hermit crabs like are not producing as many shells. So they're doing things like sticking their butts in bottles and sticking their butts in shotgun shells and stuff like this. And that's just wrong. People have uploaded different designs for shells because hermit crabs are kind of picky, and it works. The community collectively are solving an ecological problem.
What are other examples?
When Deepwater Horizon, the catastrophe that happened in the Gulf where they were drilling and oil was just flooding into the Gulf, the Thingiverse community rallied together to try and figure out, okay, what's the problem? How can we help? I'm really curious, as the community grows, to see what will, you know, not just what will one printer do, but what will 7,000 printers mm-hmm. and their users do to change the world together?
What is the Thingiverse?
Thingiverse is a universe of things. It's a place to share your digital designs. So you can, if you design something, say you design a new type of bottle opener, you can upload it and share it, and everybody can benefit.
Another project that you've worked on in the past is an art project where you exhibited works of art made by MakerBot at the New Museum in New York City. Talk to me about that project.
Yes.
This was a project that you did with Zach Lieberman.
Yeah. So Zach Lieberman and I went to Tompkins Square Park, and we took strangers and we set them down, and we asked them to tell them, who are the important people in your life? Immediately it got good when people talk to you about who they care about and share the people who are important to them. They get emotional. And we caught that on video, and we caught that with a 3D scanner. And then we printed out miniature heads about 4 inches tall of the people who had done this. And then we projected images of them talking on it. So in some ways it was kind of like, you know that moment in Star Wars where Princess Leia goes, "Help me, Obi-Wan, you're my only hope," and she's in 3D and she's projected. It was kind of like that.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bree Pettis, co-founder of MakerBot Industries, a company that makes 3D printers. Speaking of the important people in your life, you became a father in 2011, and in the spirit of sharing your life on the internet, you talked about the hardship that you faced when your daughter was born prematurely, and she was in the NICU for a couple of months. You blogged or wrote about one particular incident when she was in the NICU and no one was paying attention.
Yeah.
Can you describe that experience briefly?
So hospitals suck. The internet hasn't arrived to hospitals. And the way that data gets transferred at hospitals is people work 12 hours because they're two 12-hour shifts. And then they stay a little bit longer than their 12 hours because the next person comes on shift. And they share everything that they've done in the last 12 hours the most with the next person. And that's the way that data transfer happens in a hospital. So I had a baby named Nika, and she was born 7 weeks early, which is really early, and she was 2.5 pounds. So she had to go to the NICU, which is where they put babies in little boxes and watch them. And the second night I came back, because they don't let you be there from, I think it's 8 to 9, because that's their transition time where they're expected to share the data. And I arrived at 9, and the monitors were flatlined, which means there's no heartbeat, no breathing, no oxygen. And I was like, okay, before I completely freak out, I'm just going to check. And so I went over and I checked her pulse and I checked her breathing, and she was breathing and there was a pulse. And I started looking at, and I looked at the monitor, and it was clear it hadn't been hooked up for 2 hours. Hmm. And so I asked the nurse, I said, you know, this is why my baby hasn't been hooked up for 2 hours. And rather than saying, oh, I'm sorry, let me fix this right now, this is horrible, she proceeded to make excuses about how overworked they were, how the technology isn't reliable, how the backup systems hadn't been in effect, and how hard it was to find good people.
Making excuses.
Making lots of excuses. And if she had just said, I'm going to fix this right now, would have been fine. But making excuses meant that these, you know, four layers of redundancy had all failed, and I was the only one who'd noticed it. And I'm sure parents who are listening can imagine, you know, when you trust your baby to someone else and they don't let you be there. I was just, I got really mad.
Anything that a MakerBot could fix?
You know what, though? When I was in the NICU, I was there for 6 weeks and I basically camped out there. And I looked at all the technology there. The isolette, which is the box that the baby's in, that also has a, you know, that also has a bunch of hookups and stuff like this for it, and has air that you can pump in. You know, that costs like a lot of money, like $75,000 for that box. And I'm thinking, okay, I could do that for three and maintain all the functionality.
$3,000.
Yeah. What I did in my 6 weeks of the NICU was just sit there and reverse engineer all the stuff in the hospital, thinking, oh my gosh, I can't believe I pay this much for it.
Mm. Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
My guest has been Bree Pettis, the co-founder of MakerBot. Coming up, we'll meet Mark Ramadan, co-founder of Sir Kensington's, a condiment company. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. Hey! I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Mark Ramadan, co-founder of Sir Kensington's, a ketchup company. Mark and his co-founder Scott Norton thought, why shouldn't there be a gourmet alternative to Heinz ketchup, and started tinkering with recipes in their off-campus apartment while they were students at Brown University. Sir Kensington's was launched in 2010, and the product is available in stores throughout the United States, including Williams-Sonoma, Dean & DeLuca, and Whole Foods. The product is also available in more than 500 restaurants and hotels. Sir Kensington's also makes other condiments, including mustard and mayo. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I'd like to start in September 2004 with an article written in the New Yorker magazine by Malcolm Gladwell called The Ketchup Conundrum. Basically, the gist of it was that while mustards enjoyed a variety of flavors and various companies made them, ketchup could not share that same diversity. Only Heinz had kind of this perfect blend of sweetness and sourness and bitterness and saltiness, in addition to mouthfeel, which is called umami. Can you tell me about your first encounter with that article?
Yeah, we had this idea of ketchup long after that article came out. We didn't read it in 2004. We were in high school and we weren't highbrow enough. And we had this idea when we were seniors in college in 2007, 2008. The article was brought to our attention. We read it and we thought it was very interesting. I think, you know, in many ways, the food world is very different than where it was in 2004. You know, in 2004, Chobani didn't exist. Coconut water didn't exist in America. You know, so many things have changed since then. So, you know, when we were reading it, we had a very different perspective on what's possible. We thought that he made a lot of great points around product. Ketchup is a very nostalgic flavor. The mouthfeel, like you said, those things are really innate in people. What stood out to us is that there wasn't a lot of discussion around brand, whereas Grey Poupon really has a fantastic brand and was, he mentions, as sort of a breakout star of the mustard category. We didn't really perceive there to be a lot of ketchup brands that were doing something interesting in the same way.
He talks about this concept amplitude, which basically is a balance of flavors, and that Heinz had a high amplitude. And I have to admit something embarrassing, which is that the article came out a month before I was married. And I thought when I was giving a speech at my wedding, what am I going to say? And I used this concept of amplitude about my husband in my wedding speech.
That sounds perfect. Yeah, completely perfect. Yeah. You know, amplitude is present in everything that we eat, everything we consume, right? It's sort of in the way that it's talked about in the article, it's sort of how intense can the flavors be and how often do you want to keep going back to that flavor or how long does it take you to get tired of it? Mm-hmm. And I think Coca-Cola has a lot of that, has a lot of amplitude. You don't taste one thing in Coke. You taste many things. And so for me, having something that has high amplitude means it's balanced.
The article wasn't the germ or the inspiration for you to launch the company. How did you get the idea to start the ketchup company while you were at Brown?
Yeah. Well, the legendary answer is that we were reading about Sir Kensington in history class, and he was part of the British aristocracy and quite a culinaire. And there was a long-lost recipe that he had sort of helped develop after he went to a dinner party at the home of Catherine the Great, and he was served a ketchup that was subpar, so he needed to make his own, and we brought that back to life. Mm-hmm. The real story is that we had the idea to start the company just in the course of normal conversations around food. I mean, we were both... I have a Lebanese and British family. He has an Armenian family. And so there was always cooking going on growing up and lots of family feasts. And food was always a very central part of our lives. But we were both econ majors. So we were always talking about food ideas and ways to sort of find the intersection there. And we were just saying how weird it was that if you go to the grocery store, you're overwhelmed with choice, you know, whether it's cereal or yogurt or salsa or milk. But in this one category that is in 97% of American homes, we didn't think there was any choice.
By the way, we talk about Heinz as this, you know, behemoth, incumbent. But Henry Heinz was a maverick of sorts. You know, in the late 19th century, there was a preservative in ketchup called benzoate. And he contended that this was actually not good for your health. And he replaced the preservative with vinegar, basically pickling the tomatoes. And he won out. But it was because of his moxie that Heinz was born.
Yeah, I mean, the story of H.J. Heinz is incredible. And if you we're lucky that we don't live in the world of the late 19th century. The food world was scary. I mean, before truth in advertising laws and before sort of consumer protection, that people were putting all sorts of stuff in food, making all sorts of claims. And food was, in general, not super safe. And H.J. Heinz was really one of the first entrepreneurs to take food safety very seriously. And that was the origin of the glass bottle, which was he wanted to make sure people knew that he was proud to show what was inside. And so I think that, you know, that resonates with us.
Heinz is this iconic Americana brand, and you sought out to do something distinctly different by making this absurdly highbrow, making fun of yourself, but foodie-oriented condiment. When we say that you tinkered with recipes during college, tell me more about that.
Yeah, so it was the spring semester of our senior year. Neither of us were writing any sort of thesis, so we had plenty of time. And we just started Googling ketchup recipes. And we had really no cooking background at all. I think at most I had cooked pasta in college, and Scott had probably cooked less than that. But he had an off-campus apartment with a stove. Ketchup, to make it, in theory it's easy. In practice, it was extremely difficult. We didn't even have aprons, so we cut up trash bags to use as aprons. We didn't have proper gloves, so we used oven mitts. You know, we didn't have any pot bigger than a saucepan, so it took us weeks and weeks. And I think that off-campus apartment still smells like tomatoes. And we developed 8 different recipes that we thought were pretty good. And we hosted a series of tasting parties with our friends. And our first tasting party was the night of the biggest blizzard that Brown had seen in years. But people showed up with snow pants under their dresses, and they helped us taste all these ketchups and give us their feedback.
What is a Kensington kiss?
So a Kensington kiss was the result of not having proper protection while cooking ketchup. We didn't have, you know, the right aprons, gloves, or whatever. So a Kensington kiss is what we called the burn marks on our skin when the hot tomato ketchup would boil off and splatter all over us.
So this is senior year of college, and you both went off to do different things prior to starting the company. You worked at McKinsey in New York after graduation, and Scott went on this bicycle ride throughout the Middle East and Europe. At what point did you come back to this idea of starting the company?
As we were graduating, the idea was sort of what we thought was coming to a close. we made two formulas that we thought were great. We had a big launch party, sold all the jars we made, and that was going to be it. But we had a lot of friends who were saying, this is a cool idea. You should at least keep working on it. So actually, over the course of 2008 to 2010, we worked nights and weekends on Skype and however we could get in touch, really putting all the puzzle pieces together. And then in 2010, we had gotten it to a point where we felt like it was just waiting for someone to take it over. So I quit my job in June of 2010, and he joined in October.
We talk about the legendary start of Sir Kensington's. How did you come up with the idea of being tongue-in-cheek and being, you know, what you called absurdly highbrow in getting the concept off the ground?
When I was growing up, I was always attracted to brands that had personalities. That doesn't necessarily mean literal figurative personalities like a, you know, like a Mr. Peanut. But I think brands need to make statements, and Heinz clearly makes a statement. It stands for childhood, it stands for nostalgia, it stands for fun, and really, it stands for Americana. And we didn't want to go right up against that. And I think, you know, as much as food is about quality and taste, it's also about entertainment. So we didn't want to make anything that was we didn't want to take ourselves too seriously. So Sir Kensington evolved as this character that hearkened to British quality and British cuisine, which in some ways isn't looked at as the best cuisine in the world, but it's certainly looked at as sort of like high tea, and, you know, it's the origin of a lot of things fancy. And Sir Kensington was this character that personified these sort of tongue-in-cheek ideas that you could have quality even in the lowliest of things.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Mark Ramadan, co-founder of Sir Kensington's, a condiment company that got its start by making a ketchup that hoped to be a gourmet alternative to Heinz. What is the history of ketchup?
Ketchup actually is a 500-year-old condiment. It started as a fish sauce in Southeast Asia. Mm. It's originally a Chinese word. I think it's pronounced ketsiop. Mm. And it sort of migrated with the spice trade from Southeast Asia through Central Asia. And it eventually incorporated tomatoes, which are a New World crop. The tomatoes are from Peru. The Europeans brought tomatoes back to Europe, needed a way to preserve them, and ketchup eventually made its way to America.
So in 2010, you and Scott decide to launch the company officially. You debuted at the Fancy Food Show. And how pivotal was that for you?
For us, that was that little 4-foot table that I was standing behind with my sister made all the difference. That's where we met Whole Foods. That's where we met Dean and DeLuca. That's where we met William Sonoma. And I think in many ways we were incredibly lucky that they stopped by because we didn't know what we were doing. We didn't know how pricing worked. We didn't know what distribution was. I mean, we didn't even have a warehouse. The first order of product arrived at my apartment doorstep, and it was I didn't even know what a pallet was. I was in a doorman building at the time. Doorman called and said, "You have a delivery." I said, "Oh, great. You can just put it in the packages room." And he's like, no. This is thousands of pounds of I don't know what. And so I had to come back, and I sort of helped him unload it and put it all in my apartment. So I had a wall of ketchup in the apartment at the time.
What was harder for you initially than you thought it might be?
Well, sales were hard, still are hard. And so we were taking our cases of product door to door up and down streets of New York to places like Murray's Cheese, places like the Chelsea Market. You know, but it was hard, though, because people are busy. They see a million products a day. It's only gotten worse. These jars of ketchup were heavy, so I had them in a roll of like a rolling suitcase, and I would go into these stores, and the stores would be filled with people. I mean, it's Manhattan, so there's no room for anything, and I'm in there with my suitcase trying to get them to taste this or see this, and they just say, "I'll leave a sample, and I'll call you back," and the nice people do, but most people, even if they are nice, are too busy to call you back. Figuring out that you have to sort of be persistent while still being nice was a tricky balance to find.
Any interesting anecdotes about, you know, approaching Murray's Cheese or, you know, you mentioned Chelsea Market or, I don't know, anything that sticks out?
Well, I think the first thing is our very first New York retailer was Chelsea Market Baskets, which is a store still there, great store in Chelsea Market. And he was willing to put it up on shelf. We had most of the product in my apartment. We had some product in a warehouse near where Scott and Brandon were from in Northern California. And so our first attempt to ship, we didn't know that you had to pack glass properly. And we would get these irate calls. You know, I have a box that's bleeding ketchup. There's glass everywhere. What are you doing? And so I had to start hand delivering every week, you know, these boxes of ketchup all around the city because we had no other solution.
How did you finance the company in the early days?
in the early days, we put in our own money. It was me, Scott, Brandon, and there was a fourth partner named Wynn, who was also a college friend of ours. But as soon as I decided to leave my job and do this full time, we started to raise a bit of money from family and friends. We tried to raise money from people who were not just supportive, but had done something like this before. So some of our investors have also invested in brands like Pop Chips and Vita Coco, and we've tried to raise money from people who know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And so to the degree that we can continue to raise from people like that, that's going to help.
What are some mistakes that were made that perhaps, you know, they helped with?
It hasn't all been easy. We've made a lot of mistakes. One of those mistakes is saying yes to every store that wanted to stock us right away. It was certainly in the early days just an amazing compliment. So we said yes to everyone. And so very quickly we had product in Arizona, in Texas, in Maine, in New York, California, all around the country. And I think the dirty secret of the food world is you have to be ready to support that. Mm. You know, things don't just fly off the shelf. And so we learned the hard way over the course of 2 years. We were getting into more and more stores. We weren't really paying attention to once it got on the shelf, was it getting off the shelf? Did anyone know about it? Was anyone willing to pay? And so we had to go through a period of really pulling back. And it was actually one of our board members who has done this before who said you should really lean into your best customers. And for us, that was Whole Foods.
What are the sorts of things you did other than, you know, stand there and demo, allow people to try the product?
Stores, in many ways, make their money off of vendors, not off of the people who are buying stuff in their stores. So a lot of stores, they'll charge what are called slotting fees, which are, you know, you have to pay just a flat fee to get your product on the shelf. But then to move it, you can do things like demos. But also, anytime you walk into a store and you see a display, you know, at the end of an aisle or sort of by checkout, that's usually paid for. And so being able to have that kind of placement makes you a little more attractive, certainly more visible, because it's also on sale. We found that has the biggest impact on sales. And also hardest to get, because everyone's done this math. Everyone wants those kinds of displays.
Do you have any better answers for why Heinz dominated the market for so long, other than this amplitude answer that Malcolm Gladwell has?
I think that Heinz built their brand brilliantly by being ubiquitous. You know, something like 70 to 75% of all ketchup is consumed in food service, not in retail. So food service is basically anywhere you get ketchup for free. Restaurants, hotels, travel, schools, whatever. And it's usually Heinz. And so when you go to buy ketchup at home, you're going to buy what you're familiar with. And so for us, from the very, very beginning, it was always about how do we work with restaurants and how do we be omnipresent?
You're in more than 500 restaurants across the United States. What are one or two stories about getting your ketchup into one of those restaurants?
Our big break, I would say, on the restaurant side is working with PJ Clark's. I mean, they're an institution for burgers, and they've been serving the burger since 1884 with Heinz. I mean, the chef, his name is Mike DeFonso, phenomenally nice guy, very busy guy. And this was really our first lesson in how to sell in restaurants. There's no sort of process there. So we showed up, he tasted it, he said it was great, said he would call us, didn't call us, busy guy. So actually for like 4 months straight, we would just keep showing up at his doorstep. And he would always laugh and he'd say, "You guys, what do you want again?" And then eventually he said, "I want to do it, but my boss won't let me," the owner, this guy, Phil Scotty. And then, you know, for another 6 months, we were going back and over, trying to get a meeting with him. Kept getting blown off. And then finally, he allowed us 5 minutes in his office. And the first thing he said to us, and he was this like legendary guy in our life, right? Almost a year trying to reach this man, Phil. He turns to us and he says, "You are the most f-ing persistent guys I have ever met. What do you have for me?" And so we told him our story very briefly, and he was a smoker at the time. And we gave him an engraved Zippo lighter with PJ Clark's on it. And it was really sort of the way to his heart. And we're now very close to him and his wife, Thea, who's been like a godmother to us. And it all happened. And it was all because it was non-traditionally persistent.
I noticed that you're married. You have a ring. When did that happen?
Well, what's funny is I spent 2008 to 2010 at McKinsey desperately trying to find a girlfriend. And I couldn't. And the moment that I quit to start Sir Kensington's, I decided now I really should be single so I can really focus my time on building Sir Kensington's. And then at the Fancy Food Show, I met Rachel, who is now my wife.
What was she doing at the Fancy Food Show?
At the time, she was a partner at a design firm. Hmm. And so they were looking at packaging and trying to find cool, interesting new clients. And she and her boss had stopped by. They were too expensive for us, so we started dating instead. And now we're married.
What might I not know about you? What do you enjoy doing outside of work?
Well, I love spending time with Rachel. I also love cocktail culture. I was very briefly a bartender at a bar downtown called White Star. And I learned how to chisel ice from Sasha Petrosky, who's the founder of Milk and Honey, the seminal sort of pre-prohibition or prohibition-style cocktail bar in New York. And I started doing these bar nights in my apartment while I was at McKinsey. The whole idea was to create a space that was fun and was lubricated, but not insane. You know, wasn't sort of a 10 shots for $5 kind of place, but also not the kind of place where you had to whisper. And over time, it took on sort of a life of its own, and I created a menu, and people were bringing people I had never met before, and it got up to something like 40 people, and I had almost 100 bottles of liquor in my apartment, and it lasted for almost a year, and it had a name. It was called Mark Bar. I have plans to have sort of an underground bar component to Rachel's Cafe when it finally launches.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Mark Ramadan, co-founder of Sir Kensington's. If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.